From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, a busy summer book segment for a busy Milwaukee summer. Books for Bastille Days and Irish Fest and Zoo a la Carte.
And then a former backpacking and hiking guide writes her own guidebook to all 59 national parks, making them even more accessible for anyone to enjoy.
Most people come away just totally enriched from having whatever, even if it's a short national park experience, it comes fraught with meaning to them at having had that special moment out there.
And we learn about the undercover operation that matched the Milwaukee Symphony with a former Grand Theater.
They kind of secretly came into the theater and they removed the first seven rows of seats and they expanded the stage and they brought the orchestra in and they did some tests to see if the hall itself provided the right acoustic characteristics that they were looking for.
Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Good afternoon. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Have you assembled your summer beach reads yet? Well, not all of us go to the beach to read or even go to the beach at all during the summer. The calendar of events is pretty full between now and September, but, you know, there's always time to read.
Daniel Golden joins us in the studio now with a massive reading list for a massive Milwaukee summer. He's the proprietor of Boswell Book Company on Downer Avenue and joins us a few times a year to share some titles you might have missed. Daniel Golden, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Oh, it is always a pleasure. Thank you much, Mitch.
It is a thrill to have you here, as always. And we're going to talk about your summer book picks, but rather than talk about beach reads or the proverbial beach reads, we have another way of organizing this list. We're talking about books that have some connection to stuff that happens here in the summer. What do you mean?
Well, what I thought about is that we have so many festivals and activities that as I was looking at the list, I said, oh, this is a good book to read for Irish Fest. So I sort of took I couldn't figure out a couple, so I left those out.
We will note that there is a gaping hole. There is not a Summerfest-related book.
I usually read some sort of music novel, and I wasn't thinking ahead.
But we'll go through this list. I will read the name and ask you what these books have to do with Milwaukee in the summertime, and we'll talk a little bit
about
the
books.
And so the first one is Jennifer Shiverini's Resistance Women. And I bet I can predict this, but I will let you go ahead and tell us anyway.
Well, it does take place in Germany.
So and then I'm guessing perhaps German Fest.
I'm going with German Fest.
I figured either Germany or France here.
Yes, that's true. But
it's either
going to
be German Fest or Bastille Days.
I've got a good one for Bastille Days. So this is a historical novel, as Chiverini's been writing of late. She has followed the story of Mildred Fish Harnack, who has great Wisconsin connections. She actually grew up in Milwaukee. And for Chiverini, who writes in Madison, she's a UW-Madison graduate. She went over to Germany. She married a German man and really led a big resistance program called the Red Orchestra. The story is told through her eyes and three other women at the time. They were trying to do whatever they could to oust Hitler from office as they saw his rise to power. It is a historical novel.
I'm guessing this might be for people who really enjoy The Nightingale.
Absolutely. I mean, there are no end of stories of World War II, and I have heard people say enough already, but then they read another one and they go, wow, this is a story I hadn't heard before. And that's Chiverini's case. It's just spectacular research. She doesn't get bogged down in things like the clothes and the food. She does solid newspaper reading. I believe she brushed up on her German so she could read the newspapers. It's a wonderful book. Three of the characters are based on real people. One was sort of a hybrid character, the Jewish character, because she didn't have somebody who connected with everybody else. And I was just sad at the end that she wasn't real. You know, that's a common thing. People don't, you know, it's okay to place fictional characters into historical. But this is It's not a short book, but you can't tear yourself away from it.
So that is Resistance Women by Jennifer Kivirini. She was recently at Boswell, correct?
That's right. She did a few events, and we had somebody write to me and say, I have a great idea for an event. You should get Jennifer Kivirini. And I said, she was here last week. But actually, the great news is she does have another novel in the fall. So she's actually going back to her quilting series for a one-off Christmas book. So she'll be back.
All right. So book number two on the list is If I Wake, and I'm never sure how to say his name, but Michael
Corita,
I think. Corita, okay.
This is a thriller. I thought it is summer, and I have to read some escapist literature. So this is like a nail biter with a few twists. This guy, you know he's good because they seem to sell the rights to every single book of his to the film industry. So this book is about a woman who is effectively a very – it's kind of bookish because she's kind of like an author escort. She's taking the speaker to a college talk. But the guy asks to stop and go the scenic way, gets out, asks her a few questions, and they're by this bridge and a car comes crashing into them, killing the gentleman she's escorting and sending her into a coma. But she has something called locked-in syndrome, so her body is comatose, but her brain is active. It's a real thing. And the story is sort of told from her perspective as well as that of an insurance investigator who's trying to figure out what's going on. Now, this isn't just any insurance investigator.
Of course not.
Because she used to be. She's got some stuff in her past, and she used to be a stock car driver. But she's the one who looks at the car crash and said, because this guy has confessed to the crime. Now, he is murdered eventually, of course. But she's like, this is no accident. I can tell from the skid marks and the type of car that this couldn't possibly have been done the way he said it was. And this leads to
spoilers.
Spoilers. I'm not going to give anything away. I'm just going to say, you know, there's some killers out there, and there's several. But the one that's kind of particularly fascinating is the millennial sociopath. And he has all the tropes of a 19-year-old kid driving all the other killers crazy with his baseball cap and shot, you know, not dressing the way a killer should dress. But he certainly knows technology a lot better than them. It's good.
Okay. And so this connection to Milwaukee in the summer is?
Well, because the hero in the book is an insurance investigator, I thought, how perfect for the Northwestern Mutual insurance agent meeting. Which is every July, except next year.
That's brilliant. All right. That's If I Wake, Michael Corita. Maybe you will sell many copies to Northwestern Mutual agents while they are in town.
I'll try.
And I think I know what the connection here might be because I have read this book already, and I know the author fairly well. But brilliant Milwaukee connection. Let's talk about Antoine Laurens. Vintage 1954.
Well, you and I are both huge fans of Antoine.
We are.
And he wrote two books that I just adored, President's Hat and The Red Notebook, and a few other books I liked. But this is in my top three now of the six. It's called Vintage 1954. It's everything. It's a time travel book about four people in Paris who drink Beaujolais Nouveau that's been tainted by aliens.
and believe it or not, the book is still pretty good.
And go back, find themselves in 1950s Paris. The key here in the Milwaukee connection is that one of the four people is an American tourist, a rube, might I call him, from Milwaukee.
Bob from Milwaukee.
Bob from Milwaukee, who is an engineer at Harley-Davidson. And let me just say, I was a little worried because I'm like, uh-oh. But he's a lovely person. He's so wonderful. And if people think that people from Milwaukee are like him, I'm okay with it. What is so much fun about this book is that it is filled with little French cultural things, all kinds of writers and artists and civic people kind of bump up against our four main characters as they're trying to figure out how the heck to get back to contemporary Paris. It's not Let's just say it ain't gonna win the National Book Award.
No, but it is a wonderful. I will vouch for it also and say it is a wonderful way to kill two or three afternoons. Honestly, not a bad beach read.
A delightful beach read or an airplane read. And maybe you'll love it so much that you want to read it on the way back home, too.
If I have any complaint about that book, and I think you have it on the on the shelf here, it is with the slogan or the tagline at the bottom, which is, what is it? If you could visit the Paris of your dreams.
Yes, pretty much.
Ellipses or ellipsis.
Yeah.
Or dot, dot, dot. I'm never sure how to finish that sentence.
Well, and of course,
if you were to visit the Paris of your dreams, you would read this book. I'm not sure.
That's right, except it wouldn't have been written yet.
Maybe the Paris of my dreams is actually 5 years in the future.
That's right. Okay. Go wait a few years, then read, so you can go read it, or you can get it at any bookstore online, I guess.
So that is Antoine Lorenz, Vintage 1954. Which is definitely a good accompaniment to The President's Hat and The Red Notebook.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. So let's move forward to a book that I do not know very well, and that is Danny Shapiro's Inheritance.
Well, this is a book that is it is a memoir, and I would say it's about as page-turnery as you can get as a memoir. So Danny Shapiro has written a number of memoirs and novels, and she's written a lot about her family. She grew up Orthodox Jewish, and she has written a lot about her troubled relationship, particularly with her mother, and a very loving relationship with her dad who passes away. Well, she takes a DNA test, as many of us are taking nowadays, and gets some disturbing news. She's not related to her half-sister. What could that possibly mean? It means that what we did in the 50s and 60s in terms of fertility treatments were often misleading to the people taking part in them. Hmm. If you've ever if you've seen the film Three Identical Strangers, you know the kind of things that people were doing in separating kids and that kind of as experiments. And this is really what happened. The new truth is that we thought we did a lot of things anonymously in terms of sperm donation, and it's not anonymous anymore. So needless to say, what I'm leading to, and it's not a secret, it's on the flap copy, is her father isn't her birth father. And so that leads her to a search for her birth family. Really has been a big book, obviously, with the Jewish community. That's why I put it in the part of the JCC
I was
summer
just gonna,
festival.
I was just going to ask. I was trying to figure out which event this summer that we were linking this to.
But it's also been very popular with the scientific community and bioethics groups. Very popular with bioethics groups. I couldn't think of the festival for that.
All right. So that was Danny Shapiro's Inheritance. Let's stick with the memoir category and talk about John Flynn's Out East.
Oh, well, that's actually a beach read because it takes place on Long Island. Out East is a memoir by a gentleman working in the publishing field who, when he was a little younger and a little poorer, he grew up from a working class family. And I know this because I was in publishing too, and the same thing happened. People would get these summer shares on in various places. The Hamptons is what we would think of. And New York would basically empty out. Manhattan would disappear. And I did not have the money to do that, so I took the bus to Jones Beach every so often. But it was like a bus and then another train and a beach. So I didn't do it that much. But he is so desperate to be part of this group that he actually spends his grandmother's inheritance to go. And what happens is he's in this beach house with these very wealthy people. It's got a very Gatsby-ish quality to it because he's the Nick, and they're all Gatsby's.
Right, exactly.
There's an MTV beach house quality to it, and they've been trying to compare it to Andre Asiman because he does have this he's doesn't think of himself as gay but falls in love with a man in the book. But I actually thought of it as more of the old Whit Stillman comedies, Metropolitan,
exactly.
Last Days of Disco, especially Metropolitan, because the center of that story is also kind of a working class kid who's with these, looking at these rich kids around him and seeing it's kind of a lifestyles sociological, like, what the heck are they doing?
Okay, so John Flynn's out east. Let's switch over to Ruth Reichel?
I think it's Reichel.
Food writer Ruth Reichel, who has written a book called Save Me the Plums, also a memoir.
It is also a memoir, and is also sort of a fish out of water story. I'm so glad that we're talking about these books together. Ruth Reichel is, see, now I'm saying Reichel. I don't know. Sorry. She's written some amazing memoirs, Tender at the Bone, Comfort Me with Apples, about her life as growing up with food, as the New York Times restaurant critic. And the book I always wanted her to write was her life as the gourmet editor. And this is
Gourmet
the
Magazine.
Gourmet
this
Magazine.
About, yes.
The late Gourmet Magazine, I must say. And this is it. And it's just as great as I imagine it would be. I mean, I was just like so excited to know this was coming. She went in from being the restaurant critic where she was anonymous. So she knew everything about food, but she didn't know anyone because she had to do everything anonymously. And she gets to this magazine. She's a hippie girl from Berkeley. And everybody else is spending money like they're at the Oscars every day. You know, like she gets chided for not using her limo enough. This is how much money there was, particularly at Condé Nast. And that was the philosophy of Condé Nast. Like, we cater to wealthy people, and we are going to be starlet-type magazine icons. Mm. And, of course, that world eventually all came crashing down. And she tells about it in full color. And so that's really fascinating. Her story about trying to be a mom at the same time all this is going on to her sort of, you know, upper middle class. But compared to all these people doing stuff, she doesn't feel like she's what they are, family. But also on top of it, the food writing is spectacular. She, when they go in that gourmet kitchen, which was an amazing place, I could have read a whole book just about the gourmet kitchen. That's how interesting it is when they're analyzing recipes and arguing with each other about how to make something better and how it looks and things like that. And, you know, we have food magazines here with the Ryman magazine. So, I think those
Taste
people,
Home
at least,
and whatever,
Taste
yeah.
of Home, right. So, from Reader's Digest. So, they alone would love the book, but everybody. And our kids buyer, Amy, this is definitely her favorite adult book of the year. No question.
All right. So, we are connecting that with Farmer's Market, with
Zoo à la carte.
Oh, of course. Why wouldn't I have thought of that?
So, Bloxy by Mary Miller just came out. It is a novel set in Bloxy, Mississippi.
They might say Biloxi.
I think thank you for correcting me. I'm spoken like a true northerner.
Yes, exactly.
60-something guy, just got divorced after a long marriage. Didn't go that well. Father died. Thinks he's getting a pretty good inheritance, so he retires. Only to find out maybe he's not getting that inheritance. Got some health problems, not really taking the meds. Things aren't going that well. And he takes a wrong turn while he's avoiding somebody that he sees at the grocery store and passes this house that's giving away a dog. A free dog. So he goes in, talks to the guy, and gets Layla. And takes Layla home and starts bonding with her, only to find out that that dog wasn't really supposed to be given away. The guy who was doing it was having a fight with his wife. So it's oh my gosh. This book is a second novel. It's classic Southern literature, like the old Algonquin books of Chapel Hill. If you like Clyde Edgerton, if you like Kay Gibbons, if you like Silas House, like not the really dark stuff, but sort of like
this is not Faulkner.
It's not Faulkner. Thank you very much. But it is charming. I decided, I said, South country music, State Fair.
All right.
But
there's country music at Summerfest.
That's true. I could have done Summerfest for this too, because now we're getting a lot more diverse in all our. We're not boxing in all our festivals, which is really great.
Not just Cheap Trick and Journey.
And if I could find, there's probably a dog festival. It's a really good dog book. It's actually the second dog book that I've read in like 2 months about a dog falling into someone's life and changing it. I'm not a dog person. I come from cat stock, but I. I have to say they both – the other one was The Friend by Sigrid Nunez, and I just completely love both of them. So
that's right. That is Biloxi by Mary Miller, and you have piqued my interest. As you have on all of these books, of course. But how about Ask Again, Yes by Mary Beth Keene, a book that I know nothing about except what is written in front of me.
Well, I read this book early and fell in love with it. The publishers are always like, read this for us. We'll come to this dinner and meet this author. And boy, you'll be really embarrassed if you don't read the book. So, and then maybe you need to have a quote on it, too. So we do these sort of things. And and I was struggling because there was like a bunch of authors. And I wrote to one of my friends and said, who was at the dinner. I was like, I don't know what to read. She's like, this is your book. She's an old bookseller, so she knows how to hand sell. And she was right. I loved it. It's contemporary Irish story about two families. Both the dads are cops. They move in next door to each other in the suburbs. They're both either Irish immigrant or first generation. And then a terrible thing happens that drives them apart. However, the children are still secretly in love with each other, a la Romeo and Juliet.
A la Romeo and Juliet.
The story doesn't end there. Yes, any number.
Right.
Any number.
West Side Story.
Yes. But that's not really the story. The story is about the burden of the earlier generation on the next generation of mental illness and alcoholism. Mm. So what I loved about this book is that the writing is great. The characters are strong. I could immediately see – we sell a lot of Courtney Sullivan and Matthew Thomas's We Are Not Ourselves, Alice McDermott, some of the Colm Tobin books. Like there's this – you know, there's a wonderful – heritage of Irish writing and Irish American writing too, and this just falls right into it. Her last book was actually about Typhoid Mary. It was a novel, which also an Irish immigrant. So she's very much into that story, and that's why this is, of course, your Irish best book.
Right. That sounds like a great book. So, all right, we have a handful that we have not yet gotten to. Tell us about Patsy.
Nicole Dennis Benn.
Yes.
Well, I loved her first book, Here Comes the Sun, which won, I think, won on a Lambda Award. It was kind of a Jamaican Breaking Bad with a woman at the center. And this book is basically the narrative of that book was so awful in every way, but she had nothing but undying love for her daughter. This is like the bookend. So Patsy is an immigrant story. It's an undocumented story. A woman from Jamaica leaves Jamaica, where she has an office job, not so good, not terrible, I guess, and decides to go to New York to follow her dreams and maybe somebody, only to find that her dreams have left her behind and she's going to be cleaning houses and that kind of thing. And she is a wonderful person, a fascinating character study, but she does one off. She leaves behind her daughter. And so the story goes back and forth between the mother and the daughter. It's a wonderful story about contemporary Jamaica. It's a story about the life of an undocumented and the struggles that people go through and very much about Jamaican culture in New York. It's a kind of a dual coming out, mother-daughter coming out story as well. So, you know, if – you know, it could have worked for Pride Fest. It could have worked for the Black Arts Festival.
Is there one that you chose?
Well, I did. No, I'm splitting the difference.
All right.
I think the Black Arts Festival.
Okay.
There you go.
All right. What if we do two more here?
Okay.
And I want to make sure that we include Kelsey Ray Dimberg in this list because she lives in Milwaukee, right?
She does. And that's why maybe
we can just connect her to herself.
That's right. That's right. The celebration of – and maybe – the Boswell Summer Reading Series.
Right, there you go.
So Girl in the Rearview Mirror is a long-awaited first novel. It's psychological suspense, which I know a lot of people like. It doesn't take place in Milwaukee. It takes place in Phoenix. And it's about a young woman who is running away from her past. I don't know if you've caught the narrative theme for these sort of books. Who winds up becoming the
There are
nanny.
A lot of books that start with girl in the these days.
Right,
yes.
There is too. And really what it means is girl is a mess. And we're not going to tell you why until later. But on top of that, she wanders into this, what effectively, mystery thriller. And so she In this case, she becomes the nanny for the son of a very powerful senator in Arizona. And everything seems to be going well. She's brought into the life. She's got a boyfriend who's in the campaign for the senator's reelection campaign. And then she's left with the daughter and something happens to the daughter, the little girl that she's taking care of. And, of course, the secrets start unraveling and the conspiracies start popping up. But it's really well done. And actually, I did have another idea for what it could be, like an early pick for next year's Democratic National Convention.
And in that, we will find it with we can file it with the book that I did an interview about not too long ago called Who Killed the Fonz?
Oh,
which,
yes.
Oddly enough, had a political thriller component to it as well.
Milwaukee and political thriller. Yeah. I believe that might be the official book of the Democratic National Convention.
All right. So Girl in the Rearview Mirror, Kelsey Ray Dimberg. We'll do two more here. Kevin Henkes is a Wisconsin author as well. And we have not talked about kids' books at this point. So tell us about Sweeping Up the Heart and what we will connect it to.
Well, I do read a number of kids' books I can read a lot of picture yeah. books, let me tell you. but middle grade and especially I really like that 8 to 12, as I know you do as well.
I do as well, yes.
And this was my favorite when I read this spring. Henkes is best known for his picture books, but he's actually a whiz. You're a Billy Miller.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that.
Got wonderful laurels as well. This is a set in Madison at a pottery studio, and it is about a young girl who doesn't get to go on vacation with her best friend. And so she winds up going to this pottery studio every day where she's dealing with the disappointment and her adolescent kind of
angst.
Uncertainty, angst. Yeah. And meets this boy who she becomes friends with, who's also dealing with his own problems, mostly that he finds out that his parents are getting divorced. There's a wonderful simpleness to the story, but it's very intense, and you really get into this kid's head, and you can tell the love for the pottery studio. Henkes does make ceramic animals, and I thought that it was beautiful. So definitely worthy of an adult to read. We've had 5 people in our store read it. So
what are we connecting this with?
Well, I thought, and I had to think about if this is still summer, and it is, Maker Faire.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's beginning of September anyway, but
it is, yes.
Still technically in the summer. We'll talk about one more book, and it has a great summer connection, and one that involves Boswell itself, and that is The World's Fastest Man by Michael Cranish. It is about the life and times of a cyclist named Major Taylor. He was the first black sports hero in this country, and I thought it would be a good one for the Downer Avenue Classic, part of the Tour of America's Dairyland.
And the whole Tour of America's Dairyland. Can you imagine everybody at the tour not paying attention to the race because they're reading this spectacular history book?
You know, you hear about all city reads. Maybe they could do an all stage race read.
I would love that.
But this does a great job of explaining not only what race relations were like, but what bike racing was like at the turn of the 20th century when it was the most popular sport in the country.
It was, and everybody bicycled then. I mean, it's gotten a bit of a resurgence of late, but which is great. But it's still no 1890s.
Yeah, it is no 1890s because Major Taylor would go and ride in France, and there would be front page headlines, and people would keep track of what was going on in a bicycle race on a velodrome in France, which is a little difficult to believe happening today.
Yeah, well, it'll be front and center on our bicycle table. We'll make it happen.
And remind us, the Downer Avenue Classic goes by your very store on the 28th, right?
28th of June, yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that was a great bunch of books. We will put the whole list up on our website. Daniel Golden, thank you so much.
Oh, I loved it.
Daniel Golden owns and operates Milwaukee's iconic Boswell Book Company. You can find his full summer reading list at WUWM.com.
Now that you have your summer books assembled, why not gather them up and hit the road? We will talk with the author of a recent guidebook to the country's national parks when Lake Effect Weekend continues right after this on 89.7 WUWM.
We are back with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The United States has 59 national parks. Yellowstone was the first one, and Pinnacles in California was most recently named. And Becky Lomax has lived and breathed the parks her whole life. Her dad was a park ranger, and as a kid, she and her family would regularly visit national parks in Washington State.
As an adult, Lomax lived outside of Glacier National Park in Montana, where she worked as a backpacking and hiking guide. That prompted her first guidebook on that park, and later she added Yellowstone and Grand Teton. And now her most recent guidebook takes on the entirety of the national park system. Lomax joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski over the phone and began with a simple rule to follow when you're planning a trip to any national park.
In general, you want to plan, especially for the big national parks, you want to plan a year in advance for some of your trips because the lodging opens up a year in advance and it books out. So it does take some pre-planning for some of the parks to go visit. Others you can just kind of, you know, drop in and out for a day, and some don't even have lodging, of course. But if you want to be inside the park and say the big ones, Yosemite, Yellowstone, Grand Canyon, so forth, you need to make a year, you know, plan a year out. So that's where something like a guidebook really can help out. And then it can show you, here's a couple of parks that might link up together with road trip if you want to connect a couple parks in one trip.
What did you think was missing from other guidebooks that you could address in a better way, especially when it's something so comprehensive as a guidebook to all of the national parks?
Yeah, because that's a lot.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that we did, because obviously that's a lot of parks to cover, and I have only been to, well, I've been to more than half of them and working my way through them. We used some other moon travel writers who write about their local national parks, and we used some of them to help fill in those pieces that we needed in the book with that local flavor. So people that really know the park, not people that just kind of drop in for a week, do what they can, and then go write about it. These are people that live, like I do, outside of Glacier. We live right next to national parks, and we go there all the time, and we know what works and how to do it and what seasons and so forth. It's a lot of insider information.
As you mentioned, growing up right outside of a park, I can imagine that must have been an incredibly valuable experience for you, not only as a kid, but looking back as an adult and writing these books and exploring more on your own. So what are some of the most valuable perspectives and lessons you learned by being raised by a park ranger and living your childhood throughout some national parks?
Well, first of all, my dad was a park ranger before I was born, and after that, he moved on to other things. But his love of the national parks was something that he passed on to us kids. And I think that is just one of the best gifts that my parents could have ever given me, and the best gift that any parent could give their children, is to give them some of these experiences in the national parks, because they are all so incredibly unique. And what you get to do in them, from scenic drives to hiking, boating, kayaking, sightseeing, wildlife watching, most people come away just totally enriched from having whatever, even if it's a short national park experience, it comes fraught with meaning to them at having had that special moment out there.
As you know, and have experienced, I'm sure, sometimes special moments can be a little dwindled if you have cranky children or something like that. You know, it's a big thing to plan a national park trip, even if you're on your own. But what are some good parks to take children that can, you know, lessen some of the stressors that are kid-friendly and accessible and not too strenuous, say, of like hikes or activities or things like that?
Well, you know, one of the coolest parks to take kids, I think, is Badlands National Park. And it's in South Dakota. And if you go in summer, it's got a paleontology lab that is open, and they have some kid programs in there. And what kids don't like dinosaurs? I mean, that's kind of a made-for-kid experience there. And then some of the hikes in Badlands are just, they're really fun, short, little boardwalk sections or trails that go out into these crazy, eroded, magical places. And kids really like seeing that type of stuff. Just north of that, in North Dakota, is another, it's less traveled park, but it's got so much wildlife watching in it, and kids love seeing wildlife. And that would be Theodore Roosevelt National Park.
No, I was just there this past summer. I spent a day there.
Awesome, isn't it?
It was great, yeah.
Yeah, did you get to see the wild horses?
Yes, actually, we were hiking up a path, and coming directly in the opposite direction on that same path was a horse leading a few others. And I have not gotten off a path more quicker in my life. Like, I went straight up that hill, you know, it was a little nerve-wracking.
But they are so, you don't get to see wild horses too often, and that's a pretty cool place to be able to see them.
Yeah, it was amazing. And in addition to the bison, and you know you're in a park, but it's definitely off the beaten path.
Yes. And one of the things I recommend for families is every single park has a junior ranger program. So get the kids into that program. And what it is, it's stop in a visitor center, you pick up the junior ranger booklet, and it's for that particular park. So all of the activities in it are educational ones that the kids get to learn about wildlife and the ecosystems and so forth. They fill out the book, do all the projects, take it back to the visitor center, and then a ranger there looks at their work and then swears them in as junior rangers, and they get a badge. And a lot of kids collect these badges.
And that's a great way to keep it engaging beyond there. And with national parks and the visitation, more families are coming, more people are coming, which is great, but that also can have some negative side effects. So, you know, how do you avoid an experience like spending the entire day in a car in Yosemite because you simply can't find a place to park and the roads are only two-way?
That is tricky. Well, one, if you have the option in some of the parks to take shuttle buses and so forth, do that. It just makes it so much easier to get to those trailheads or get to those things that you want to see. The other thing is, if you can plan your day, most people in the national parks are out and about between 9 and 4. So if you can make use of that early morning time or that evening time, you can actually have some really cool short trail hiking experiences or sightseeing experiences or scenic drives, where you're not battling all these cars or people. And that's pretty cool.
So I'm calling here from Wisconsin, and while our state doesn't have a national park, what are some destinations to see near us here in the Great Lakes region?
Well, the closest parks to Wisconsin are about 6 to 8 hours away. They're all different directions, too. So you've got, over in Ohio, you've got Cuyahoga Valley, and that's kind of a historic park. Along the canal system, an old canal system. So there's a wonderful 20-mile trail, the old towpath. You can actually bike and hike. Two other parks, which I call water parks, they're one's in Lake Superior, and that's Isle Royale. And you can go up to the UP and then catch a boat over to Isle Royale. And that's a great place to see moose, go hiking, go paddling, and just enjoy the remoteness there. And the other one is Boisier's National Park up in Minnesota, northern Minnesota, and that's got four giant lakes. And that's a place that's really good for boating and kayaking and fishing. And they have tons of boat-in campsites. So you pile everything, instead of taking the RV out, you pile everything in a boat or a houseboat, and you go to these campsites that are out there kind of remote and can really feel solitude if that's what you want to look for.
Right. And on that note, you know, people may assume if they're doing a national park trip that it is going to be fighting the crowds or getting the kids up out in the car super early in the morning. But there are lots here that people perhaps don't think about exploring right away. So what are some parks that are best for solitudes, either in their visitation frequency or just simply the geographics?
Well, Boisier's is definitely one because it doesn't get the huge crowds. The others would be, you can almost turn any park into a less crowded experience, especially if you can go off-season. And, you know, one of the experiences that I've done it several times, and I'm just blown away every time, is going to Yellowstone in winter. And you take a snow coach into Old Faithful, you spend the night at the snow lodge, and you may be one of 15 people out there watching Old Faithful geyser erupt.
You've had a lot of experience going to different places, not only professionally, but personally. So I'm curious, what's your favorite national park right now, I suppose, that everyone should visit? I imagine it changes a bit.
Oh, you know, well, it does, because it's always whatever park I'm in at the moment. But, you know, Glacier has to be one of my favorites, and that's partially why I live here. It's just such a rugged, beautiful park, and the mountain scenery, it's so chiseled by glacier. It just is magnificent. And because it's got so many miles of hiking trail, that once you get past about the 3 mile mark, people thin out. And especially backpacking, you can have some incredible backpacking experiences in the park where you're not around tons and tons of people.
There is that juxtaposition when you're out past a certain hiking point where there's not many people compared to some of the busiest parks. How do you recommend people engage with our national parks and nature enjoyably while being respectful and also sustainable? Because dealing with the population and the people coming into the parks, I think, is also going to be a challenge into the future for our national park system.
Totally. And I think one of the things that we need to recognize is every time we go into a park, we are affecting that park. And I think if we can do things like take more public transportation in the park that gets fewer individual cars out there buzzing up and down the road, I think if we also can limit things like our use of single-use plastics when we're in the park, instead of buying the water in the bottle that you throw away, we can take reusable water bottles. And the parks are putting in water bottle refill stations everywhere now, so it's pretty easy to, you know, to refill those water bottles. And then the third thing I would recommend too, or well, actually two other things. One is absolutely take binoculars when you go. Wildlife watching should be done through binoculars, so you're giving these animals space. And that's for your safety and for their safety. And the last thing is definitely take little bags with you so you can corral all your micro trash, your little bits of wrappers of things and tissue papers and all of those. Make sure that they stay with you and they go back out with you.
What would you say to someone who has never visited a national park? What would you say to encourage them to take that step?
I would say it's a wonderful experience. And what they should do is they'll feel more comfortable is if they plan ahead for their first national park experience and make sure that they take two things along with them. One is water, and then I always have snacks too. But also take, especially for the mountain parks, make sure you take along layers of clothes, because you can be out there and it could be feel like shorts weather, so you're kind of running around in shorts, and then, you know, 3 hours later it's rainy and cold and maybe even snowing.
Well, Becky, your book, USA National Parks, The Complete Guide to All 59 Parks, it's hopefully helpful, too, to encourage some people to get out and explore, and I want to thank you for taking the time to share a little bit of your knowledge about it with me today.
Thank you so much, Audrey. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Becky Lomax is the author of Moon USA National Parks, The Complete Guide to All 59 Parks. Lomax joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski by phone. There is a link to more about the guide at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, Bubbler Talk takes a tour of the Grand Theater. It's not quite finished yet, but we'll find out more when Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Annalise Henzel. Like many cities, Milwaukee once was home to a number of movie palaces, places where the surroundings were nearly as much of a draw as what was playing. These were single-screen, sometimes luxurious venues, well before the proliferation of TVs and later suburban multiplexes. They had special features like air conditioning and newsreels.
The World's Fair represents the world of tomorrow, but there's plenty for the people of today to see and to do by day and by night.
Bubbler Talk listener Dante wanted to know what happened to one of those theaters, the Grand, previously known as the Warner. It was built in 1930, just off 2nd at Wisconsin downtown. It's still there, although it's been out of operation since the 1990s. CinemaTreasures.org describes the theater as the fanciest in Milwaukee and one of the most beautiful in the nation. It has colorful murals, layers of decorative details, and reflective walls in the lobby.
It is an experience when you walk into the theater. It's very decadent.
That's Christopher Ludwig, an architect with Kaler Slater in Milwaukee.
It touches on Art Nouveau, Art Deco, Baroque, Rococo. So it's like a little bit of everything. You see some German influences.
The next music you'll hear when the doors reopen will sound more like this. The Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra has acquired the building and is turning it into the MSO's home. Currently, the MSO shares space with other organizations at the Marcus Center for the Performing Arts. The architect we heard from earlier, Christopher Ludwig at Kaler Slater, is the lead designer for the MSO's Symphony Center. He says well before the MSO bought the building, it made sure the space would work.
They kind of secretly came into the theater and they removed the first 7 rows of seats and they expanded the stage and they brought the orchestra in and they did some tests to see if the hall itself provided the right acoustic characteristics that they were looking for. So that was pivotal.
But the project involves challenges and new construction. For instance, the stage isn't deep enough for the orchestra, so the wall of the building that runs parallel to 2nd Street needs to be pushed to the east. And a 2-story addition is being built with lots of large glass windows right on the corner of 2nd and Wisconsin. Ludwig says it'll accommodate things like special events and a place for cocktails before a performance.
It became very clear that the contemporary addition needs to be simple, elegant, and respect the history and not overshadow. At the same time, it needed to bring a fresh energy to the equation, a delicate balance.
Ludwig says the historic decorative touches are in pretty good shape, and planners are preserving as many as possible. That includes by shipping lighting fixtures to out-of-state specialists who are restoring them. Former Grand Theater employees recently toured the space, seeing it for the first time in decades. Donna Ronghold-Megan, who worked there in the 80s, was pleased so many of the decorative details are still in place, including a prominent mural in the lobby. It features a red-haired woman, barefoot and simply dressed, scattering flower petals on the grass.
I was very excited to see that the lady was still at the bottom of the stairs. That mural, it was one of my favorite things when I worked here, and that was very significant for me.
I very much agree on the lady. Also, this lobby, it's a construction site right now. When it is cleaned up, when the chandeliers and the sconces are put back in, when it's properly lit, and the mirrors on either side and on the end opposite the Juliet balcony, when it's all lit up, it's beautiful.
Joe Tomei visited the theater with his wife, Dawn Cher Tomei. Dawn points out that the two met while working at the Grand Theater in the 80s. She says she's glad it's still around, unlike other spots that played an important part in her life.
You know, my grade school doesn't exist anymore. Other places I've worked don't exist anymore.
Dawn and Joe are among countless people who have stories to share about the old theater. And when it reopens as the MSO's Symphony Center, they'll bring their kids to check it out. The project is expected to be complete by the fall of next year. I'm Annalise Hensel, 89.7 WUWM.
What have you always wanted to know about Milwaukee's people, places, or culture? Visit WUWM.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
Finally today, we're going to dip into the Lake Effect Archive and listen back to a music recording from our performance studio. Wisconsin has nurtured plenty of musicians over the years, and while many go on to big things, there are some who have done a lot to give back to the communities that they call home.
That is the case in the Fox Valley for native son Corey Chisel, who created a foundation supporting artists in the region and also helped launch the Mile of Music Festival, which brings dozens of musicians and thousands of fans to Appleton in the summer. Corey Chisel and his partner, Adrielle Dene, joined us in the performance studio in 2012 and played a set, including this song from the album Old Believers.
Well, let me make sure it's in tune. That's good. Well, do a song called I Never Meant to Love You, but it's too late now. I said I never meant to take you to the party last night. And I never meant to kiss you in the pale moonlight. Well, there's nothing I can do about it now. I said I never meant to love you, but it's too late now. Oh, baby, you can love me like a bowling ball. Yeah, you can roll me all night and I won't complain at all. There'll be times when we're striking every pin. Well, you can set him up, honey, if you knock him down again. Say you'll never be less than my guiding star, but we'll never be more than the people we are. And I don't know why, and I don't know how. Yeah, I never meant to love you, but it's too late now. I never took myself for a family man. Now I'm running to the bedroom every chance I can. You draw the shades, let your head down, you pull me in. Well, I can feel your blood rushing just below your skin. I said I'd always be a prisoner, I'd always be your slave. Because you gotta love someone in between the grave. And better you, darling, than my own selfish device. Yeah, if you think I don't need you, then baby, think twice. Say you'll never be less than my guiding star, 'cause we'll never be more than the people we are. And I don't know why, and I don't know how. Yeah, I never meant to love you, but it's too late now. Looks like you're stuck with me, darling, till the ends of time. Well, when we climbed every mountain that there was to climb. You look at me, you finally see me just as I am. I said I never meant to love you, would you love me again? Say you'll never be less than my guiding star, 'cause we'll never be more than the people we are. And I don't know why.
Corey Chisel and Adriel Denae playing I Never Meant to Love You, But It's Too Late Now in the Lake Effect Performance Studio back in 2012. And while it's too late now to hear the rest of this Lake Effect Weekend, you can always go back in time and listen to it at WUWM.com. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend comes to you every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 4 o'clock, and All Things Considered comes your way next.
I said I never meant to love you, but it's too late now. Darling, I never meant to love you, but it's too late now. I said I never meant to love you, but it's too late now.